Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. And today we have Dr. Brian Toohey. He's an assistant professor in the Center for Urban Bioethics at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine and an affiliate faculty in the Department of Sociology at Temple University. He completed his PhD from the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago in 2018. And from 2018 to 2020, he was a postdoctoral scholar in the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. He also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in the Health Disparities Research Scholars Training Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison from 2020 to 21. Brian's work has appeared in academic journals, including Social Forces, the American Journal of Bioethics, the British Medical Journal, Medical Education, and City and Community. And he explores issues at the intersection of healthcare and immigration reform, and also wants to stress the importance of incorporating carceral health within medical education curricula. His current book project, tentatively titled Mexican Chicago, Between Belonging and Exclusion, highlights these immigration issues through a five-year ethnographic examination amongst a socially similar group of children of immigrants that differ on whether or not they have citizenship. Dr. Toohey was recently selected to be a public policy lab fellow at Temple University for the 2024-25 academic year. And during this fellowship, he plans to explore the significant role state policy and local context plays in immigrant health, with particular attention to the pre, peri, and postnatal experiences of undocumented people across different policy environments in the US. Furthermore, Dr. Toohey founded and is the co-chair of ASBH's Immigration Affinity Group. And he states that the situation of the more than 10 million undocumented immigrants in the US today represents one of the great civil rights issues of our time. So you're very, very welcome, Dr. Toohey, and thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for reading that lengthy bio of mine. So thank you.
I also just want to add for our listeners, we want to thank all our listeners. We're starting a new season today and really happy that people are listening, and we appreciate all our listeners. If you have any suggestions for any topics or any speakers, please reach out to us. And I also just want to mention, if you have an interest in immigration, we did also have Dr. Rachel Favey on, another immigration expert. She was on an episode during season 5, so feel free to check out that episode as well.
Thanks, everyone. We love you all.
So, Brian, you are a trained sociologist and a passionate educator and academic. So can you give us an idea of your journey to becoming a bioethicist?
Sure. So it's nice to be on this podcast with you all and to see you on this computer screen. So I think that when I consider how I've become a bioethicist, I think like I could describe it as like a linear path, but it's definitely not been that. So where do I begin? I did my PhD in sociology at UChicago, as you mentioned, and my dissertation research is interested in legal status and health outcomes broadly construed. And so when I was on the job market, I was applying, I applied for probably 330 jobs over 4 years, and I did 2 postdocs, as you mentioned, and I was looking for the right kind of fit, but I was looking in sociology departments, I was looking in medical schools, I was looking in public health departments. And so the job that I ended up getting was sort of like a dream job that it would be a lie to say that this was my plan all along. Like, it came up and I got this position at Temple and in the med school. And so in their Center for Urban Bioethics. And so I believe the question was, how did I become a bioethicist? And I would say that you know, it was honestly, it was, you know, this position was really important in terms of like bringing me into the world of medicine formally. And it's something that, you know, through the work that we've done over the last couple of years, it's something that has just grown. So like the first year that I was a faculty, so I started in fall of 2021, you know, starting to go to ASBH and sort of learn the world from the beginning, like maybe 4 years ago. So like, it's something in which I still consider myself like a novice and like a newbie. There are things that I really like about bioethics, things I don't quite understand. You know, I feel much more conversant in the world of sociology, and but it's something that I'm growing in bioethics and med ed. There's just a lot of like disciplinary boundaries, and like how much they actually matter is an interesting question. And so I think like it's something that's grown over the last 4 years. And I think like, you know, starting the immigration group, which Amelia, Dr. Barwise is part of, is, you know, has been helpful in connecting with folks who have similar interests, but are working in like different spaces. And I'm sure we're going to get into a lot of these things, but one of the, you know, the most exciting aspects of bioethics that has like motivated me and is that we're in privileged worlds and spaces like of medicine, and sociology is sort of on the outside often. And like, so with this job, like I'm inside of a medical school. And so that's a little bit about my journey. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's me.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think we're all learning bioethics. And it is great to have all the different disciplines. And I really, really like your work. So happy that you're coming to ASBH. And just can you give us an idea of, you know, we've talked about undocumented immigrants. Can you give us a sort of quick overview of who we're talking about and some of the specific issues that they face?
Yeah. So I think, like I read it on my website, like, you know, one of the great civil rights questions of our time is like, you know, there hasn't been comprehensive federal immigration reform since 1986. That's, you know, when I give a talk, like that's now, it keeps getting longer and longer. So it's like 38 years. You know, so that's, and there's, you know, between 9 and 11 million people that are undocumented. What does that mean? Like without legal status. And this has implications across different areas of life, like employment. It's more difficult to get employment in the formal labor market. Insurance is an issue. Driver's licenses. It's something that, because there hasn't been this reform in 4 decades, decisions about immigrant rights are made at state and local levels. So, you know, there's wide variation across. So you guys are, well, Dr. Barwise is in Rochester, Minnesota, I think. And Kirk, I think you're in New Jersey. Is that right? That's my home state. And I'm in Pennsylvania. And so the rules around something like, what is prenatal care like for people who are undocumented? It's different across the states. So it's an issue that, like, you know, honestly, my parents emigrated. Well, they came to the U.S. They're both from Ireland. My dad is from Limerick, or was from Limerick. My mother is from Belfast. And, you know, my dad came over for a summer to do this, like, Irish sport called hurling. And, you know, they gave him a job during the summer, and he realized he could make 50 to 60 times more than he was making in Limerick. So he just basically stayed. And my mother, something similar, where she, you know, she would escape the troubles kind of in a sense, and met my father in this bar that they were both working at. And then they ended up staying. They were undocumented until there was the last comprehensive reform was in 1986. So the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was passed surprisingly by Ronald Reagan, which granted blanket amnesty to millions of people, including my parents. And so I've always been interested in like immigration and legal status generally, and like, and also like the experience of being like, so I don't know if this is on camera. If it's not on camera, I'm a tall white male. And like, what is it like to be, you know, it's been interesting, like the experience of connecting to Irishness is something that like has not been, it has like been an interesting process. And so like, what is the idea of becoming American was something that interested me. And so like, am I automatically American because of the fact that my parents are white and they speak English, like, and like, why does that differ across groups? And like, how does that differ? And like, what are the implications of those differences? So like, those are some of the things that like, I've always been interested in, like just intellectually. And like, you know, I remember when I was in fourth grade, like I had my first, like a birthday party, and like some like kids like ran over to me and like, Brian, your dad, he sounds so weird. And like, that was the first time when I was like, oh, you know, maybe there's something different. But like, so just my own, you know, immigrant experience, which doesn't feel like, I feel like sometimes like a fake when I say my immigrant experience, just because of how privileged I am in certain categories, like, it's been really like fascinating intellectually. And to be honest, I don't even know where I started with that answer. And so I'm going to stop here.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So before we kind of move on to some of your other papers, I just wanted to touch on your paper, Health Without Papers, Immigrant Citizenship and Health in the 21st Century. So you had done this work in Chicago, which I just finished that, and you kind of described different friendships and scenarios in which not having any insurance, because some of the football, the soccer players that you were playing with didn't have insurance. Some of their friends were very similar, but did, and how that impacted more than just their access to hospitals. It impacted so many other aspects of their lives. So, and you have this phrase, the 1.5 generation and the status signaling. So can you tell us a bit more about that terminology, and Summer, maybe just give a little brief overview of a couple of those little vignettes that you use to highlight the issues.
Sure. Thank you for reading that. The paper took me like 3 years to write, and I was on version 76. And, you know, sociology is a weird world. Like, anyway, so the paper, so this was a chapter of my dissertation. And so let me say a little bit about my dissertation. I did a 5-year ethnography in a soccer facility in Chicago. And why soccer is an interesting question. So I played soccer in college, and I've always in the world of sociology, ethnography is like, has always been the one that, like, all these books behind me are, it's the most interesting. Like, I enjoy qualitative research. Like, I feel like it's exciting. And so I wanted to do like what we call a Chicago school ethnography, which is like, you know, just like, there's a famous quote from some guy, Robert Park, who said, you know, you getting the seat of your pants dirty in real research, like, and so just like being in the world. And so like, you know, I was interested in legal status issues, and like, what kind of worlds could I study, and like, what could I get immersed in? And so, I've always, growing up, like, I, you know, soccer skill is on a continuum, like, you know, from messy to like, to other, to very low quality. And so like, but I, you know, I was on the end where I was, you know, college level, and like, to find good soccer growing up in New Jersey, as I mentioned, Kirk and like the Ironbound, you go to immigrant areas to like, to play. Like, it's always, that was the case in the 90s and 2000s. And that's another conversation. But so I knew that there was like worlds that I could enter. And so I just started basically playing this facility and hanging out. And that's how the dissertation kind of started. And so, and the article looks at, so I mentioned the 1.5 generation, which is not my concept. I think Ruben Rumbau is the one who came up with this from one of the California schools. But the idea is like, someone was born, let's say for the United States, someone was born outside the United States, but came here before prime socialization years, which is usually defined as like, I don't know, anywhere between eight or 12 ish. So like, and so this group now is also synonymous kind of with our idea of the dreamers, and people who are eligible for DACA, deferred action for childhood arrivals. And so like this group, is fundamentally different than those like myself in the second generation. So people that were born in the United States, but parents born outside the US, and the first generation people, probably like Dr. Barwai, is born outside the US, but you know, then has become, you know, then comes to the United States. So, And why are they different? It's because like it is this like socializing process that happens in the US, and like, so like they go to the similar schools, they play on similar soccer teams, they have friends with similar levels of social and human capital, but they just differ on this key variable of legal status. So like you have undocumented 1.5 generation and citizen second generation folks. And like, that's the two groups. I just realized quickly that like, it was, you know, these groups are basically almost the same, like indistinguishable in many senses, yet their lives like radically differed. And so I look at specifically in this paper, like the Affordable Care Act was being debated and then implemented during the time that I was doing my dissertation. And like, you know, so that was something that, you know, was the greatest expansion of social insurance in recent American history and gave access to millions more people to have health insurance, but like explicitly excluded undocumented immigrants from participating. And so it just was like, you know, you have this like natural sort of thing that happens outside in the world where, you know, a group is now eligible for this thing that provides, you know, mainly for young men, healthy-ish men, like existential relief, like financially, like if something bad happens, like, like what health insurance actually provides for like the folks in my dissertation and in this paper. But it's something that is not possible for someone in the 1.5 generation. And so, yeah, so the paper kind of talks about how this, the ACA sort of unintentionally exacerbated the differences within immigrant groups. And so, you know, within this group of like these friends and teammates and people that I hang out with for a few years, like, again, very socially similar, but I would call a status signaling event is some, the ACA is an example of that, like whereby it just reminds folks that they're different. And like the implications of that for thinking about like, you know, deservingness narratives and healthcare is like, is really, you know, powerful. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing. Also, had a question in regards to one of your articles about immigration in general, but about LEP or limited English proficiency. And you drew a really interesting connection to individuals with LEP and the social determinants of health. So I'm curious, what is the connection in your particular lens between the two, between limited English proficiency and how the social determinants of health are connected to that?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think like, you know, Heidi Castaneda wrote this famous article in 2015, well, famous as in like for us, like, you know, it's cited like 5,000 times, like immigration as a social determinant of health. And like, so that is something where she sort of set the agenda. And this was relatively recently, like, it's one of those articles where you're like, you know, like, it's like one of those things that like, is now obvious, but maybe wasn't as obvious before. And so limited English proficiency is like is a category within this. Like it's, so the thing that I stress or I emphasize in the response to Dr. Barwise and Sam Chipman's piece is, you know, the importance of like what we call intersectionality, which is, you know, this popular theory in the social sciences about like, you know, so it's the way in which different social variables matter in your experience of the world. So it's not just race, it's not just class, it's not just immigration status, but the way in which those interact in the world. So it sort of connects with my, you know, my own narrative about, you know, what it's like for like a child of white English speaking immigrants to navigate the world as opposed to a child of Mexican undocumented immigrants in Chicago, and like how race plays a role, how language status plays a role. So I think like the key variable is like the key thing that I think about when I think about immigration or limited English proficiency is like, you know, not to be too academic-y, I feel like I might be going that way, like, but the heterogeneity within the category of immigration is like immigration is like a gigantic variable. Like, there's so many different groups, so many different cultures, so many different, there's all different kinds of legal statuses. We've been talking about it now, like as if it's two, but there's, you know, a lot more. There's refugee status. There's, you know, people that get green cards, and like, and there's people that get high They get visas for like, I forget what they call it, like the high tech visas. Like, so there's just a lot of different categories. And so, you know, when we think about something like limited English proficiency, that definitely, it matters so much in the experience with the healthcare system, but like it also matters how it interacts with other variables. And I think that's the key point that I try to stress in some of my writing.
No, excellent. A great point. And to continue with focus on complexity and immigration, you did mention, of course, intersectionality and its relation to a legal status. So for those that do not know, what is intersectionality and how is it related to one's legal status?
Yeah, and, you know, I wouldn't, so like with the concepts of like 1.5 generation, intersectionality, these are not mine. Like, and so like, you know, there's a whole body of like work. I mean, Kimberly Crenshaw is like the, I think the like the big one you should cite. But like, you know, basically is this idea that, you know, it's not just race that matters. It's not just class that matters. It's not just gender that matters. It's not just labor context, not just immigration status, but like how these things work in connection with each other in the social world and in the context that they're in the United States, like in the United States, or if it's a different place, like it's just a really strong theoretical tool for better understanding the social world. And like, it would surprise me if we didn't know that before, but like, I don't know what they knew before Kimberly Crenshaw wrote that piece, you know, like, well, I mean, I guess we can read, but like, yeah, it is something that is just like a key idea theoretically. Like, I think it's well established now. And like, and then and with immigration status and how that connects to legal status, it's like, there's just such wide differences. Like even within the group, for example, of Mexican Americans in the United States, there is like the first generation, there's 1.5 generation, there's second generation, there's like people from different areas of Mexico, Mexico City or Oaxaca, like, and this stuff all matters in a way. And so like, it just adds that, as you were saying, adds complexity. And like, and when we're trying to make arguments strong, like we need to have that kind of like grasp of the nuance. And I think something like intersectionality helps me to like better understand and think through things. So, yeah.
No, thank you for your perspective on that. And of course, Kimberly Crenshaw, she coined the term intersectionality. I know it's a term that we use a lot, but much credit to her. She's a professor at Columbia Law School, as well as UCLA Law, for those who are not aware of this giant in the field, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw. My last question, at least for now, before I turn it back over to my colleague, Dr. Borowise, is the dynamics of bioethics, right? Of course, our podcast is called Bioethics in the Margins, and we're looking at different demographics, different groups in the margins that we aren't researched or talked about very much. And of course, undocumented immigrants are one of those groups that are literally in the margins that often are overlooked. What are the challenges of researching and gathering research of undocumented immigrants? I know there's a lot of difficulty and again, gathering research, but also researching this particular demographic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think speaking about bioethics, like there's like huge ethical issues around like thinking about power and in doing research with vulnerable populations or doing research, it's like, you know, this distinction I talk about in the class that I teach about community engagement, about like doing research with versus doing research on. And so like, it's just, I think what are the challenges of researching? It's, you know, one is like, you know, making sure that these power dynamics are addressed is something that matters. And yeah, in terms of like, so do you want me to talk specifically about like research on or like the experiences of, so like just specifically about research?
Yeah, specifically about research, because I know one of your particular articles did mention there's a lot of nuance because of, I guess, either the scarcity of the research or trying to obtain particular research of that a particular group.
Yeah. And so one of the articles we wrote with my So with a colleague, Jillian Jatris, it's at my Center for Urban Bioethics at Temple, basically the idea was like, what is the ethically, like, what is the right way to do work with, do research with undocumented populations? And so, you know, this is a 1500 word piece. So like, it was hard to, you know, lay this out, but like, it's just like establishing some just key principles and key ideas for how to go about doing research ethically, is sort of one of the key ideas. You know, I think there's, so we get into the specifics of like, there, you know, there's an issue with privacy with regards to like whether or not people that are undocumented want to have, like, if you're doing informed consent, like, a lot of folks don't want to sign paperwork and have official paperwork out into the world. And so like, there are ways that the IRB can understand and recognize, you can make the argument that this is not necessary, that you could still get informed consent without having a paper, like a paper trail is like sort of like one of the ideas. I think we also argue, just like, it's surprising to me, like IRBs in general, like some folks just don't like it, they vary significantly across universities. And so just having experts on the populations in which people are studying and like is something that really should be, like, everybody should have consultants or like that understand the dynamics of legal status and like what the implications are when the work is being done for thinking about ethical questions. Like, that is, it seems like a bare minimum. So like, we sort of, the article is like, this is the bare minimum. If you are going to, if you're interested and you're listening and you're interested in doing work with undocumented folks, like, this is just a paper in which you could get the, like the basics down and some citations and to get you on your way. So we sort of lay that out.
I just want to come back to one aspect of what you were both talking about, the LEP, because I'm trying to now move away from the LEP designation. So I'm just going to use this podcast platform to promote a term I prefer, which is NELP, non-English language preference. So I'm trying to use that word. Some people use a like PLOE, preferred language, other than English. But just since, you know, all that work was done and, you know, we've moved away. So our old work uses LEP, but now I'm trying to transition to this new term. Just, I want to talk a bit more about, like, you mentioned that now you're in this medical school and you love it. So you developed this wonderful course, Immigration, Health and Urban Life. So can you tell us who you're teaching, who's taking the course, you know, what you feel about medical students, what they're, are they interested in social determinants of health and vulnerable groups? And do you think they're going to take this knowledge and use it in their practice? What are your thoughts about, do you have optimism about that?
Wow, those are big questions. So I think, why do I love teaching med students? I think like there's just a lot of potential. I get excited about the idea that I can have an impact on future providers. And so like, I think there's like just something there that is powerful. And so like just seeing the path of that. And so like at my med school, you know, I teach in a couple of different ways. And so the, you know, one of the things that we learn quickly in med ed is like the curriculum is so tight that like, you know, I get like 2 hours every for 4 years to teach about immigrant health. And so the class that I developed that you were speaking about is for our, we have like a dual degree in MD, MA, which sounds like ecstasy, but like MD masters in urban bioethics. And that's about 90% of those students are dual degree MD students. And, but, you know, unfortunately, like, this is something that they pay extra for, like to take the class, to do a master's degree. But like the class, it gives me the opportunity to develop like a full syllabus over 16 weeks about like some of the great, there's so much work being done in immigrant health. And what people know about that is, yeah, there's just a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff out there, and it just gives me more of an opportunity to make people familiar with like some of the big ideas. And so I think, yeah, like in terms of the question about like optimism, I think like med students that I meet now and students that I interview, like the energy comes from below in terms of like interest in social determinants, interest in something like immigrant health. Like it's never the case that I will be giving a talk on immigrant health and it won't, like, there's always people in the audience. Like, it's like people care about this topic. Like because it affects millions of people in the United States, throughout the world. Like it is practically important. It's theoretically important. It is like, it just, I feel like we know that it really matters. And so, you know, I think in terms of the students, yeah, I think like the thing that really just, again, excites me is just, you know, if I get 100, the other day I was teaching a group of 70 residents, emergency physician residents, and just being able to like establish like that idea that like, you know, wherever you end up going to practice, like it's really important. If you care about immigrant health and you care about being an advocate, understanding the rules of and policies and of what is in the area that you are in can really make a difference for the folks that you're treating and working with. So I think like, yeah, there's just, you know, when I was teaching sociology, it kind of felt like one step removed always, like I was doing a battle intellectually. Whereas when I teach MDs, like I feel like they're just going out into the world and they're interacting with people. And I just feel like the effect can be like, I don't know, quicker and more real. I don't know if that's true or not. I hope it's true. Like I go between optimism and pessimism and we'll see what happens in November. But if I'm going the optimistic train, like there is a huge power in education, and even just being in front of students for an hour and a half, like 2 hours in their like social determinants of health thread, just to have them think a little bit differently about, you know, patient-doctor communication. So I just feel like there's a lot of potential there.
I think it's brilliant. Just as we begin to wrap things up, do you think that undocumented immigrants, things are looking better or worse today, if we don't think about what might happen in November, but just today, how do you think things stand for undocumented immigrants?
I think it would be hard not to like just comment on the election. I think like it is like historically contingent. Like I think it's actually an enormously important moment. Yeah, I've been back and forth about like, you know, I don't want to freak out about this. But I think like it is a really important moment in terms of like the administration and some of the ideals that we think are potentially central to democracy. And so in terms of like what undocumented life is like, you know, now compared to 10 years ago, I think some of the challenges are very similar. I think often it really depends where you live. Like there's just, it really is like, you know, the US is just many, many different worlds. And like, you know, so like there's really powerful, awesome work by, her last Cervantes et al. Like, so she's a doc, I think, in Colorado. And so she works on end-stage renal disease. And like, if you have end-stage renal disease and you live in Texas versus end-stage renal disease in California and you're undocumented, the chances of dying are way higher in Texas because you have to like present to an emergency room and get dialysis, what they call like emergent dialysis. Whereas in California, there's a mechanism whereby in Medicaid, whereby you can get dialysis 3 times a week. And so when Connecticut was deciding what to do, it ruled that what they do in Texas is substandard, irrational, and cruel. So substandard in the sense that medically we know that you should do it 3 times a week. Irrational in that it's actually more expensive to do like the emergent dialysis in an emergency room, and cruel in sort of the ethical sense. And so I think like, what is life better? Is life, I think like it's similar in many respects. I think people will have strong arguments either way. I think what actually matters, like, you know, where do you live? Like what connections do you have to like social capital in like the world's like, you know, I did my field work in Chicago, which is one of the most progressive places in the US. So Los Angeles is probably the best place you could be if you're undocumented in the United States, you know, best as in relatively speaking. But Chicago is really, really great. And what I found in my work is like, there's also a distinction between like a place being progressive and having policies and people knowing about them and who knows about it and how do they come to know about it. So I think in some senses things are better, but like it really, like some people are doing better than others. And like, it depends, you know, often on the states, especially like something like, you know, Rachel Fabbi's work, which is brilliant. And I love her about like prenatal care, like even the start of life before the start of life is shaped by like where you live and what you have access to and whether or not like, you know, there's coverage for the mother or just coverage for the unborn child. There's like different policies and rules across states about like the doctors can only do certain things in states that like when it's the fetus inside that has a problem, but not the vessel. Or, you know, I don't even know how they describe the language. I think Nancy Berlinger has like some work on like, you know, this idea, like what's the idea called when doctors have, you know, moral hazard, like knowing that a situation is not the way it should be and not ideal and still having to work within those constraints. So I don't know what my answer is. And I do know that it's going to be, it really does depend on November what happens.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your input on that. I also just have a follow-up question regarding bioethics. And I would love to hear your take on what do you think the role of bioethics should be in immigration, right? Because usually in bioethics, we sometimes really focus on the clinical aspects within the four walls of the clinic. But of course, immigration, even though immigrants of all different statuses, all different backgrounds, all different intersectionalities come in the four walls of the clinic, right, when they need medical attention. But what do you think the role of bioethics should be immigration? Should it be more pronounced, more recognized in this field?
Yeah, that's another great question. I think that's like a central existential question of like this field or this discipline. And I try to get at that in the recent piece about like, what does bioethics mean? And, you know, there was an article, like a Target article in AJOB recently that was sort of like a survey of bioethicists and how they view things. And like the general like response that I had while reading it is like, what is bioethics? Like that's, and again, like, you know, I'm only here for 4 or 5 years. So maybe it's like, I need to do more reading and work, but like, I'm trying to understand like where it is and what the point of it is, what the idea of it is like. And so I wrote this with a couple of colleagues, and Lisa Lee, who is fabulous, and she worked on the Obama administration and like a big bioethics committee. And so I think, again, the thing that's exciting is like bioethics is in this world of power. Like it is like within, like medicine is so powerful, and like there's such elite privileged spaces. And so with that, there's potential, I believe, like I feel like, and I just, you know, this morning, like I taught like 60 M2s about how to do like better job of social determinants of health screeners, like and how to think about it. Yeah. So like we're in this realm of power, I think. And so what should bioethics do? You know, there's big arguments in like sociology about like whether or not advocacy is something that's objective, and like, and there's like thousands and thousands of articles and books written about it. And it's kind of like all BS, like a lot of it's BS, like academic stuff. And like, but I think like we can take us like, because we're focusing on normative arguments and like what is and isn't ethical. Like it's not like, I remember talking to Dr. Rachel Fabbi, my first ASBH, and talking about these questions about immigration and bioethics. And she's like, you know, it's got to go beyond just saying that it's unethical, because we know it's unethical how undocumented immigrants are treated. And so how do we go about changing and influencing the system? For me, it really has been like, I feel like it's in teaching. Like I love teaching. I get energy from students. I just like talking about ideas and knowing that they're going to be in the world and working with people that they could make have a better healthcare experience. Like, but there's also like intellectual, like the writing, like what should articles and what should, you know, we be trying to publish in New England Journal of Medicine. And like, I think like the role of, I think bioethics can play more of like a, you know, there's a lot of articles I've seen recently, like Keisha Ray, like thinking about social justice and bioethics. And like, I think there's potential there, but like how to ground that intellectually is a question I'm not I think is interesting. And like just listening to some of your podcast episodes, it's like definitely something you guys care about and think about. And so like, yeah, I think like, what's the point of my life and my work and like, why am I teaching and why am I think like we have potential to make people think a bit differently, and that's exciting and powerful. And just as someone that's been, so I'm like someone that's coming from sociology, and like, I just, you know, I could see like the world of bioethics differently, just in the sense that like, it really does, like it is connected to these worlds of power that I've just not been in. Like, just going to the AAMC recently. Oh my God. Costs like $5,000 to like go to the conference, and they have like better food, but like, it is like, it's just like, joking aside, it's like, there's real power. And I think that we can play a role. So it's thinking about how to best do that. And like, I think there's different mechanisms. And for me personally, like teaching is the one that like, I don't like writing. It's so hard. And teaching is fun.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Brian. It was really great to have you on. And yeah, look forward to seeing more of your work. And thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to both of you. I really appreciate this conversation, and hopefully it made some sense.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.